and thanks for tuning in to AP on Play. My name is Anjali Prasad. I am a local attorney here in Bloomfield Hills. I practice family law, criminal law, and today my guest is Joran Rubin, who is a partner at Rubin Frampton, also family law, criminal law attorney. Like me, she's a former federal prosecutor. Yeah. She came to Michigan after practicing in Brooklyn.
Right.
And welcome. We can't wait to talk to you and hear from you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Joran, let's start with, you worked at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn and in Detroit.
That's correct.
Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, I started in the Brooklyn office, which a long time ago, and things were done differently there. I was in just doing civil work, which included forfeiture work. So, to be clear, my criminal practice is limited to defending forfeiture and restitution. I don't really work on the main criminal case like you do.
Yeah, so let's just clarify for the viewers. I might work on the main criminal case. That's somebody's charged with a crime, and it's my job to navigate his or her guilt or innocence. Joran comes in when that individual who's been charged with a crime has been convicted and essentially is sitting on a lot of assets.
Basically, and sometimes I come in before because the way I look at a prosecution, the way the government does these prosecutions, it's the jail time, which is your expertise.
Right.
And then there's also, I mean, why do people do crimes? It's for money. So they're trying to get the money back to the government or whoever the victim is. And they have two avenues the government uses. One is through forfeiture, which is one set of laws, and that they can do before the person is convicted of any crime. So it kind of has some constitutional vibe to it. Like, it just doesn't feel right to be able to do that, but it's allowed. And then after that, after they've been sentenced to their jail sentence, they also would be subject to a restitution judgment, similar to just a judgment you might get, a regular judgment, and the government would then enforce that judgment and collect against any assets that are owned by the criminal.
Okay,
defendant.
So let's put it into terms that our viewers can understand.
Sure.
Let's say I have client A who's charged with, let's say, healthcare fraud.
Yep.
And client A is a physician who happens to have, let's just keep our math simple and say $5 million.
Okay.
In asset, in cash, in homes, what have you.
Sure.
So I'm hired to represent client A. I'm maneuvering his guilt or innocence.
Right.
And you might be hired to manage the asset part of the case, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Because unless there is an underlying violation of a federal law, and this also, there's state cases as well, so you have to have the violation of, you know, a crime. So that's, if you can be successful and they're found not guilty, then there's no forfeiture, no restitution. But let's just say they're found guilty or they plead guilty, then the next step is to look at, okay, what assets can the government seize for forfeiture or for the restitution to pay back to the victims. And where my expertise is in looking at when they take the assets, what third parties' property rights could be involved. And so let me give you, based on your example, right?
Yeah.
I'm a doctor, I committed healthcare fraud, but I've been a doctor for 20 years, my crime was in the last 2 years. What happens to the 18 years where I've bought houses, I have a family, I have college accounts for my children, I have a home my family lives in, I have retirement accounts. That's where I come in to assist someone like you who defends the first part of the crime to really look at what are the third party's rights for the whatever asset the government's trying to take.
Okay. So we'll stick with our hypothetical.
Okay.
What about my house? What about my client's house? And let's assume client has, you know, a wife and minor children.
Sure.
Can the feds take the house?
So it's obviously based on the facts. And what the first thing they look at is, how is your house titled? If it's titled to a married couple, then they cannot take it until there is either a divorce of the parties or someone dies, or they sell the home. So they put a lien on it. And that's how they preserve their ability to take the defendant's interest in the home.
Okay. So if the defendant is married, I assume they'll have a 50-50 interest in the home.
It's this quirky, it's an indivisible 50% interest because of the way the laws are in the state of Michigan, and I'm not sure of other states, but even though it's a federal case, they'll look at the Michigan law, and because it's a spouses, then there's special protections given to the spouse of someone subject to a forfeiture order.
Okay. And what about the presence of minor children? Does that matter at all to the government, or are they just going to take the house regardless of who lives there?
Well, it should matter, but of course they're looking to get their money,
yes.
And so no.
Okay.
It's more the kids wouldn't be on the title of the property.
Right. Okay.
So, no.
Have you seen cases in which somebody's convicted of a crime? There's minor children living in somebody's home, and the government has taken the house and essentially said, minor children, good luck to you?
Well, hopefully, if I'm on the case, that doesn't happen.
Yes.
So, no, I haven't
okay.
seen that. But
have you heard of this? Can they do this? Because to me, this is, I know the feds want their money, but come on, are we really now living in a society where we're kicking children out of their homes?
Of course, that's a huge piece of the negotiation. But, I mean, if the home was purchased with bad money and it's only in the name of the person who committed the crime, technically they would have a right to do that. Now, there are laws that protect people that live in the home. And I would say in my experience, when we've had these situations, the government is not horrid. Maybe they'd give them some time to live there, finish the school year, and then let them get on their feet.
Right. Okay. So that is asset forfeiture.
Correct.
As opposed to restitution.
Right.
So let's tell our viewers, what is the difference?
So forfeiture is gives the government the laws to seize assets by a defendant before they're convicted. And they do have to show by probable cause, that the asset is involved in the crime or was that like a direct proceed of a crime. So for instance, if you're a drug dealer, let's say, alleged drug dealer, and I sell you cocaine and you give me $100,000, that $100,000 they can seize under forfeiture laws. On the other hand, if you are a healthcare provider and you have assets in your business bank account and you provide legit services and then maybe not legit services, you're mixing good money and bad money. So they'll seize that bank account and then there's an opportunity, which they can do under the law, but then there's an opportunity for third parties who have an interest in that bank account to say, hey, wait a minute, this is how I pay my employees, this is my payroll, please, you got to take off, give us back the money. So that's forfeiture before the conviction. After the conviction, part of someone's sentencing would be the restitution, which is a judgment, and it's enforced by seizing assets, even that are owned legitimately, that are clean, I would say, and they're allowed to seize that up to whatever amount your judgment is.
Okay, so for our viewers, to keep it simple, the restitution
sure.
would come after the conviction, correct?
Correct.
So let's say I have a client, we'll keep our $5 million just to make things simple, who's been convicted of healthcare fraud in the amount of $5 million.
Okay.
Is it correct that they might seize some assets, but that if the assets don't total the $5 million, then the client needs to pay restitution?
That's correct.
Okay.
And usually they are allowed to enter into a payment plan with mm-hmm. the government, which is based on their income, but if they're convicted, they're usually going to prison. They're not going to be a doctor when they get out, so their payment plan is usually reasonable.
Right.
But if they are putting any assets in their own name after they get out, The government, they'll come after your house, they'll come after your car, they'll come after bank accounts, businesses, they'll come after everything. And I had one case where the man transferred the home to his mother after his indictment, because he wanted to make sure everyone had a place to live. And then the government filed a case against the mom because they said, oh no, even though the mom technically owns it, was funded by the criminal.
Ooh.
Right. So that's what they do.
Yeah, so once you start transferring assets to your spouse, your parent, maybe even your child, then you've gotten them essentially involved in this dirty business.
Which they may or may not know.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because if the person is transferring assets to avoid the debt to the government,
mm-hmm.
such as the former mayor, Kwame.
Yes.
That's why the government would have the authority to go after the asset, even though it's technically owned on the title by someone else.
Okay, so let's move from our hypothetical to the former mayor, because
sure.
we're reading in the... This is what my understanding, but you're the specialist, so jump in when you need to. I think the former mayor has been saddled with millions of dollars in restitution?
I think 1.5 he's left to pay.
Okay, so he has to pay 1.5
something
million.
Something to the IRS, too. Oh,
okay, so he has to pay, let's say, 1.5 million. And from what I read, he just bought maybe an $800,000 home?
Well, technically, he didn't buy it, right? His wife's LLC bought it.
But I thought, if I'm married, then I buy a house, the house belongs to me and my spouse. Doesn't matter who's actually putting the down payment in or paying for the mortgage.
That would be correct.
Okay.
Under family law, which we both do, if
yes.
we're going to get a divorce. However, if you put an asset only in your spouse's name and you do so to avoid a debt, so in Kwame's case, he doesn't want to show that he had the money to buy such a house in, then that's when they come in and say, no, you can't do that, because you did it after you have a judgment, again, that the government has the judgment. So you're trying to avoid that judgment.
Jordan, does this smell fishy to you? Because it smells fishy to me.
Well, let me say this. I've represented many third parties, and if the Kwame's wife had an inheritance, if she sold something, if she was in a car accident and got a settlement amount, and it's legit, the down payment that I understand there's a large mortgage on the home, so if she can prove how she got that money and that it wasn't because of money that her husband gave her,
mm-hmm.
she should be okay.
But don't both of them own the home?
I understand it's an entity that she owns that owns the home. It depends how it's titled. It's a corporation, I think, that owns, in this particular case.
Okay, so if you were still at the U.S. Attorney's Office, mm-hmm. how would you attack this monster?
I would say that this home was purchased. Where did you get the $150,000 for the down payment?
And how do you do that? How do you ask the wife where'd the money come from, or is there a more sophisticated way of tracing this?
Yeah, they would file a complaint against the wife
okay.
to get the asset back, and it would be called a fraudulent conveyance. That would be what the law that was violated. And it's a civil proceeding.
Okay.
And they would file it against the wife and say, you think you own it, but you got it fraudulently, so now give it back to us, or sell it, or give us the value, the equitable value that's left, and you can keep the house, give us the $150,000, something
okay.
like that.
But is it safe to say the feds are going to investigate this? I mean, this is kind of a well-known criminal and a well-known crime.
Of course, he owes $1.5
million. And a well-known presidential pardon.
for sure. Of course, he's, you know, and from what I understand, they haven't done much to prosecute or to collect the restitution prior to this recent case. So I know that he also collected money in a GoFundMe.
Yes.
And they might be looking into that. But again, it's definitely, I've never heard of a GoFundMe case and who owns that money. So it's going to be interesting, that's for sure.
Wouldn't it be a lot smarter to stay off the government's radar, Joran? I mean, if you're kind of well-known to begin with, had a high-profile prosecution, owe a lot of money, I mean, isn't it kind of better to make yourself obscure and anonymous?
Absolutely. That goes for everyone as a defendant who gets out. They should, because that judgment, it stays with you for 20 years after you leave prison. So that's when the 20 years starts.
Yeah, I feel like in a lot of ways, people just kind of poke the angry bear.
If they catch you, one way, yeah, and they can always, they'll take your tax intercept, they'll intercept your tax refund.
Right.
So you got to always make sure that, you know, you stay under the radar, yes.
Yes. How do they manage, now, you also practice family law like
yes.
me, so since we're on this topic, let's mm-hmm. roll in child support to this mess. What if I owe tons of restitution to the government, and I'm also paying child support? Are they going to make me? Are they going to take my child support payments away so that the government gets paid?
I wouldn't imagine the federal government would do that.
Okay.
But that's interesting. I've never had that happen. And like you said, I do both like you. But most of the time when you go into prison, your child support goes to zero while you're in. So, you know, who's ever left is picking up a lot of pieces anyway when
yeah.
their spouse goes in.
I'm just wondering if there's any kind of either explicit or implicit policy downtown at the U.S. Attorney's Office to kind of, when it comes to minor children, tread a little carefully. Maybe don't kick them out of their house. Maybe make sure they have child support. I don't know if this exists
yeah,
or not.
No.
It just seems...
That makes sense, and the people are kind people that work there, so I think when they... They could be legally right, but maybe they feel like, okay, this isn't cool. How would this look in the news?
How would it look in the news?
So sometimes that, you can get a little traction as a defense attorney that way.
Yeah. So one of your specialties is protecting people from giving all their money to the feds.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe that's slanted.
Yeah, it's twofold. I want to make sure that whatever money the government is taking from the wrongdoer is legitimately ill-gotten gains.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
But I mostly like to protect the, and I call it like the collateral damage
collateral
people.
Damage, yeah.
I mean, you could be married to a doctor, and of course you're a doctor makes a good living, and you might not... You don't know anything that's happening.
And we've seen that in our cases.
Many.
I mean, we've seen spouses, parents, children. A lot of times the wrongdoer is very secretive about the wrongdoing.
As they should be, right?
Yes.
They don't want to get caught.
Yes.
So, right. So, I again, like you're saying, my specialty then is to preserve the third-party rights the best I can to make sure that they are not wronged and that their interests in whatever property is taken, mostly marital homes, joint bank accounts, college accounts. That's a tough one, but I try.
Can feds take a college account?
They sure do. I know, right?
Wow.
Because again, the money they have to trace the money if it's from a crime.
Yes.
And the child is the third party beneficiary
yes.
of it. They didn't contribute to it. So that sometimes it's a tough one.
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I was reading your website and I saw that you also handle airport seizures.
Yes. So there's a law. If anyone's ever traveled overseas, when you sit down, you fill out a form. Are you carrying more than $10,000 of cash? And the idea being that if you're a criminal, you have cash. And we were kind of laughing that that's really if you're a drug dealer, you have cash. But other kinds of white-collar criminals really do everything. Now it's all electronic, and they're not carrying cash. But so you have to fill out one of those forms to affirm that you're not carrying more than $10,000. And if you are carrying more than $10,000, you have to just tell the government why, and then they'll pull you off the flight. So most people know this rule. So if you don't fill out the form correctly and they flag you and you have more than $10,000 of cash, they'll take the cash. And that is always a forfeiture in the civil domain jurisdiction and not always criminal. Because you might I've just made a mistake counting. But that is, that's the airport seizures. And there's, it kind of dovetails also to a crime that we call structuring, which is people that accept cash, like maybe gas stations or check cashing places or things like that. If they deposit in one day more than $10,000, the banks require them to fill out a form, suspicious activity reporting form.
Okay.
It's an 8300 form. So that's another place where this $10,000, and I think most people have like a vague feeling like I shouldn't have more than $10,000 of cash. And those are the two places where the government's going to question you if you do either deposit more than $10,000 cash or carry it in or out of the country.
Okay, so let's say I'm going, I don't know, someplace exotic, and I'm taking 15 grand with me.
Yep.
You're telling me when I get to the airport, there's a form I fill out that says, how much cash do you have? And I write 15 grand.
They will question you.
Okay. And if...
And you'll say, I earned it here.
Mine.
I just withdrew it out of my bank yesterday. I knew I'm going on this trip. And probably someone like you who files tax returns and is a legitimate lawyer. They should let you go because they wouldn't have the probable cause to seize it. But let's say you're someone who has just saved the money over time and you don't have your tax returns, or you can't say I'm a lawyer, or you know, you have some other, you're a bartender and you are paid in cash a lot, then they're going to have a lot more difficulties than someone who can show the ability to pay.
Is all this going to be fleshed out at the airport, though? Like, am I going to miss my flight because
you're
of this?
You're missing your flight. Yes, you are.
Okay, so I'm taking large amounts of cash with me, number one, viewers, declare it. And number two, viewers, make sure you can account for it. Yes?
Yes, I would say better to get it, not to do that. Better to wire transfer it to, or figure a different way than taking it in cash.
Yeah, that's probably the best answer.
Yeah, it is. That's the best answer.
So somebody might get detained, miss their flight, and hopefully find you.
Yep.
And you will help them get the money back.
That's correct. But it takes time.
That was my next question. How long would you say it would take? Let's just talk about an innocent. We'll talk about an innocent traveler.
Sure.
And then a not so innocent traveler.
Okay.
How long is it going to take for Joran Rubin to get in there and resolve this case?
All right. So unfortunately, government moves slowly. So they seize it from you. They'll pull you off of the breezeway thing, and they'll take you for questioning. They'll say, why are you carrying so much cash with you? And then they take the cash, and they give you a receipt. You then have 30 days, the person that they took the money from, to file a claim. Then the government has 90 days to file something with the courts to say why they took the money. And then you argue it. So now we're up to 4 months,
yeah.
And that's the best scenario. So,
is this the type of thing that will go to trial if you can't reach a resolution, or no?
Yes, it'll be filed as a civil forfeiture against the money.
Okay.
And they'll say you didn't declare it, and there's a specific, you know, you weren't truthful on that form that they give you, the customs form. And, then if it's not settled, most of the times those cases are settled because, in my experience, it's a legitimate person who made a mistake on the form, and customs is actually pretty cool about returning the money like that. Or it's someone, we'll dovetail into the second part of your question.
Yes.
If you really, you have, whatever you do, you don't have records
you
of why you
yes.
have the cash. And even, not even you're doing something illegal, but maybe you're avoiding paying income tax. So then they are going to extract tax from you then. But
yes.
you usually get something back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always important to get a good experienced lawyer to help you to negotiate the best settlement you can negotiate.
What about gold or, you know, items of value? Am I going to have a problem with customs if I'm taking, I don't know, $15,000 of diamonds overseas?
You know, I've never had a case like that of the person carrying it. I've had cases where the this is like real customs law, like that you're importing something illegal. Like I once had a case involving Iranian carpets because they were illegal during the. Like, this dates me, but it was a long time ago. But
we couldn't bring Iranian carpets into the U.S.?
Nope.
Was it?
There was a.
Yeah, in the 80s, I guess?
Yep.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And, but otherwise, when you bring something into the United States, you have to declare it, and then if it could be illegal or not.
Actually, I know this because of ivory.
Oh,
you cannot
okay.
bring, I don't know if you still can't, but back in the day you couldn't bring ivory in. And we would travel to India and try to bring ivory in, or maybe we were stopped at customs, something like that. So it's not just cash, it's assets too. You must mind what you're allowed to bring in and not
exactly.
bring in.
Exactly. It's a whole different thing, and that's a lot more black and white, in my opinion,
yeah.
As far as negotiating, and certainly if you have it, it's yours. There's the presumption that you own it, and
right.
that goes for cash or an asset.
Yes. Okay, well, let's talk about your experiences as a prosecutor versus your experiences as a defense attorney, like me.
Uh-huh.
We've done both sides of the aisle. What
yep.
what do you like more?
I really enjoyed my experience with the government, and the people that worked there became my really close friends because you have time to develop friendships and you're all like-minded. Everyone's paid the same, so no one's out there
right.
competing like that. But the casework, I definitely prefer being on the defendant side, the defense side. I do feel that the government should not be able to overreach. They have a narrative that they follow when they think they understand a case, and they start seizing all kinds of assets and ruining people's lives. And I feel that it's important that those people that are being affected by the government have good representation, and that the government makes its case.
Are you seeing trends in prosecution or charging?
I would say that definitely there's less civil forfeitures and much more criminal forfeiture work that is coming out of the office, which is due to some laws that have been changing where it's making it a little more difficult to do the civil forfeiture, especially in the state of Michigan. There was a law about 5 years ago that says you can't even take the forfeiture unless you are charging the person that you're taking the cash from. With a crime, a drug crime.
What about the types of crimes that are being charged? Like I do a lot of healthcare fraud.
Right.
Are other crimes even getting charged? Because it
absolutely.
Seems to me. Okay.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of PPP fraud. From the COVID.
COVID money. Yes.
Yeah, the COVID money and the COVID money. There's the healthcare fraud. Mail fraud, wire fraud, they're all different kinds of frauds. And of course, drugs, a lot of drug crimes as well.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the drug prosecutions have, it just seems slow and steady with the drug prosecutions.
Absolutely.
Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, Joran, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. Anytime.
Stay in touch, and thanks for coming. Thanks for tuning in to AP on Play.
Thank you.